You are listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Balance in Teaching. This is Lecture 3, entitled Supersensible Physiology in Education, given in Stuttgart on September 21st, 1920. It is essential in life to have the relationships with our surroundings in proper order. We can eat and digest suitable foods furnished by the outside world. But we would be poorly nourished if we ate food already partially digested by other people. The important point is that when we receive things from outside us in a definite form, they acquire value for our life because we need to work on them. It is the same at higher levels too, for example in the art of education. Here, the important thing is to know first what we should learn, and then, in the light of what we have learned, what we ourselves must actually invent in handling our class. If one studies education as a science, consisting of all sorts of principles and formulas, it means about the same thing in terms of education as choosing to eat partially digested foods. But if we undertake a study of the child, of the true nature of the human being, and learn to understand children in this way, we take into ourselves the equivalent of what nature offers us as nourishment. And in the practice of teaching, there will awaken in us, out of this knowledge of human nature, the art of education in a quite individual form. In reality, the teacher must invent this art every moment. That is the point I wish to make as an introduction to today's talk. In teaching and education, there is a curious interweaving of two different elements: the musical, tonal element that we hear in the world, and the pictorial in the world that we see. Of course, other sense impressions are intermingled with what we hear and what we see, and these can at times have a secondary importance for the lesson. But they do not have the same significance as seeing and hearing. It is essential that we really understand what is actually going on right down into the body. You know that modern science distinguishes two kinds of nerves in the human being, the so-called sensory nerves, which are supposed to run from the sense organs to the brain or central nervous system, from which they transmit perceptions and mental images, and the motor nerves, which are supposed to run from the central nervous system to the organs of movement, setting these in motion. You know that from the point of view of spiritual science, we have to challenge this classification. There is absolutely no difference between the so-called sensory nerves and motor nerves. Both are one and the same. The motor nerves primarily serve no other purpose than to make us aware of the moving limbs and the actual process of motion the moment it happens. They have nothing to do with stimulating the will. Therefore, we can say that we have nerves running from our periphery, more toward the center, and we have nerves running from the center to the ends of the organs of motion. But fundamentally, these are one and the same nerve strands. The essential point is that there is an interruption between these equivalent nerves, so that the active soul current streaming through a, in quotes, sensory nerve to the center, for instance, is interrupted, as it were, at the center, The essential point is only that there is an interruption between these equivalent nerves, so that the active soul current streaming through a sensory nerve to the center, for instance, is interrupted, as it were, at the center, and there must jump across. This is very much like the passage of an electric spark or current that jumps across an electric switch when the transmission is interrupted. It is a jump to the so-called motor nerve, which does not change at this moment, but remains the same as a sensory nerve, except in one respect. The motor nerve is capable of becoming aware of motion and of the moving limbs. There is something that can give us an intimate insight into this whole organic process, in which soul currents and bodily happenings interact. Let us assume, as a starting point, that we are looking at a picture, that is, a perception conveyed primarily through the sense organ of sight, a drawing of form or shape of something in our surroundings. In short, anything that becomes a possession of our soul through our eyes. We must now distinguish three distinctly different inner activities that occur at this moment. First, we have perception as such. This perception takes place within the organ of sight. Secondly, we must distinguish comprehension. And here we should be clear that all comprehension is transmitted through our rhythmic system, not through the nerve sense system, which transmits only perception. We comprehend what a picture is, for instance, only through the fact that the rhythmic activity, regulated by the heart and lungs, is carried through the cerebrospinal fluid up to the brain. In reality, comprehension is transmitted physically by the rhythms that occur in the brain and have their origin in our rhythmic system. It is through breathing that we are able to comprehend. How mistakenly these things are generally considered by physiology today. It is believed that comprehension has something to do with the human nervous system, whereas in actuality it is based on the fact that the rhythmic system receives what we perceive and forms a mental picture of it, and then works further on it. Because the rhythmic system is linked with our comprehension, the latter is closely related to our feeling. Those of us who study and observe ourselves carefully will see the connection between comprehension and emotion. Actually, we have to feel the truth of something we have understood if we are to agree with it. It is our rhythmic system that supplies the meeting place for our comprehending knowledge and the soul's element of feeling. There is still a third aspect, to take in what comes to us in such a way that our memory can retain it. With every event, we have to identify perception, comprehension, and an inward working over of what we have understood so that our memory retains it. This third element is linked with the metabolic system. The most delicate inner metabolic processes going on in the organism are connected with memory, with the capacity for remembering. We must pay very careful attention to these processes, for as teachers we have particular reason to know them, know about them. Notice what a different kind of memory pale children have compared with children who have nice rosy cheeks, or how different with regard to memory the various human races are. Everything of this kind is dependent on the delicate organization and processes of the metabolism. We can, for example, strengthen the memory of pale children if, as teachers, we are in a position to see that they sleep soundly, so that the delicate processes of their metabolism receive greater stimulation. Another way of helping their memory would be to bring about for them, in our teaching, a balanced rhythm between mere listening and working on their own. Suppose you let the children listen too much. They will manage to pay attention, and they will also understand if they are pushed, for they're breathing all the time and therefore keeping their brain fluid moving. But their will is not sufficiently exerted. The will, as you know, is connected with the metabolism. If you let the children get too much into the habit of watching and listening without doing enough work by themselves, you will not be able to teach them properly. Mental assimilation is connected with the metabolism and will, and the will is not active enough. You will have to find the right balance between the children's listening and watching on the one hand, and having to exert themselves independently on the other. The result of the children's working over by themselves what they have seen and heard is that their will works into the metabolism and enkindles memory. These are subtle physiological matters that will have to be grasped very exactly by means of spiritual science. All this has referred to the pictorial element, the visual experience of sight. It is quite different in the case of everything that relates to the element of sound, to the more or less musical element. I do not only mean the musical element that lives in music, which serves as the clearest and best example, but everything to do with what we hear, with what lives musically in language, and so forth. I include all of that when I speak now of sound. However paradoxical it may seem, the process here is the exact reverse of the one just described. The sense organization in the ear is inwardly linked in a very delicate way with all those nerves known to modern physiology as motor nerves, which are in fact identical to the sensory nerves. Everything we experience as resonating sound is perceived through the nerve strands embedded in our limb organism. Everything musical, if it is to be perceived properly, must first penetrate deeply into our whole organism, and for this the nerves of the ear are suitably arranged. And then it must seize hold where the nerves are otherwise reached only by the will. Those regions in the human organism that convey memory of pictorial experiences are the very ones that, in the case of the musical audible element, give rise to perception. Therefore, if you look for the area in the organism where memory of visible perceptions is developed, you will also find the nerves that convey the actual perception of sound. That is the reason, for instance, why Schopenhauer connected music so intimately with the will. The will zones, where visual images are remembered, are also the place where the perception of sound as mental image arises. The comprehension of sound as mental image also takes place in the rhythmic system. That is what is so impressive about the human organism, that these things intertwine in such a remarkable way. Our visual images meet with our audible images and weave themselves into a common inner soul experience, because they are both comprehended by means of the rhythmic system. Everything we perceive is comprehended by means of the rhythmic system. Visual images are perceived by the isolated head organism. Audible images are perceived by the whole limb organism. Visual images stream inward toward the organism. Audible images stream from the organism upward. You must combine all this with what I have said in the first lecture. If you are sensitive enough, it is not difficult to make the connection. Through the fact that the two worlds meet in the rhythmic system, something arises in our soul that comprises both sound experiences and sight experiences. The musical, everything audible, is remembered in the same region where the visible has its sensory nerve organs. These are, at one and the same time, the organs that appear to be sensory nerve organs, as ordinary physiology calls them, but in reality, they are connected with the metabolism. They convey the delicate metabolism of the head region and bring about musical memories. In the same region where the perception of visible images arises, musical memory, in fact the memory of anything audible, comes about as well. In the same regions where we perceive the visible, we remember the audible. In the same regions where we remember the visible, we perceive the audible. And the two cross over each other like a lemniscate in the rhythmic system, where they dovetail and interlock. Anyone who has ever studied musical memory, a wonderful and mysterious thing, even though we all take it for granted, will find out how fundamentally different it is from the memory of something visible. This memory for music is based on a particular delicate organization of the head metabolism. In its general character, it is also related to the will, and therefore to the metabolism. Music memory and the memory of visual images are located in different regions of the body. Both, however, are connected with the will. When you have reflected on these things, you will be impressed by how complicated the speech process is. Because the rhythmic system is so closely linked with the speech organism, comprehension comes about when the speech process unfolds from within and works outward. It comes to expression in a remarkable way, and in order to make it clear, I should like to remind you of Goethe's theory of color. Besides calling the red-yellow half of the color world warm and the blue-violet part cold, Goethe brings color perception and tone perception closely together. He sees, as it were, a different kind of sounding in the red-yellow portion of the spectrum from that in the blue-violet part. And this connects, for instance, with major and minor in music, that is, with certain more intimate aspects of tone experience. You can find this in those of his writings on natural science that were published from the unprinted material of the Weimar edition and were then added to the last volume of my Kirchner edition. Footnote, cf. Especially volume 4, part 2, pages 102, etc. of Goethe's Naturwissenschaftliche Schriften, edited by Rudolf Steiner. Goethe to Johann Leonard Hoffmann. And a footnote. We can certainly say that if we look into ourselves at these inner processes in the same way that Goethe looks at and describes the theory of color, we arrive at something remarkable. It is within the human being. It is in speech that sound comes to life. Indeed, the element of sound lives in speech, but the sound is modified in a definite way. I might say it is permeated by something that dulls it down when we speak. This is not just a metaphor. We have to do with actual processes when we say that in speech the real tone has color. The same thing happens within us as it does in the case of external color when we perceive it tonally. We do not actually perceive tone in external color, but in a sense we hear something sounding out of every color. The same occurs inwardly when we listen. We do not see a color when we pronounce e or oo any more than we hear tones when we see yellow or blue, but we have the same experience when we feel color as we have in sound when we hear the tones of speech. Here the world of sight and the world of sound interpenetrate each other. The color we see outside in the world has obvious visual qualities, but also a subtle tone quality that enters us in the way I described in a previous talk. Speech, coming from within us toward the surface, has an obvious tone quality, but also has a subtle color quality in the various sounds, which rises upward to expression, particularly in children up to the 7th year, as I have told you. From this you see that color is more pronounced in the outer world, and sound is more pronounced in the human inner world. Cosmic music moves beneath the surface in the outer world, while beneath the surface of sound within the human being there streams and moves a mysterious astral element of color. And now if you rightly comprehend the marvelous living organism that comes forth from the human being as actual speech, you will feel, when you hear it, all the rhythms of the astral body within the colorful air movements that pass directly over into the words that sound forth from us. These rhythms are, of course, also active in us in other ways. But here they become strangely agitated, concentrate themselves toward the larynx and receive their impulses, for instance, from sun and moon. All this produces a certain play of forces in the astral body that comes to external expression in the movements of the larynx. Now you have the possibility to at least picture this. As you listen to any kind of language, observe, if you can, the astral body, which at once passes its rhythms on to the etheric body, making the whole process more inward. If you could draw a picture of all this, you would get only the intrinsic movements found in the human organism, that is, the eurythmy that is always being carried out together by our astral and etheric bodies when we speak. There is nothing arbitrary here. You would merely be making visible what otherwise is constantly taking place invisibly. Why would we do this at the present time? Because today we must do consciously what we formerly did unconsciously. The development of the human being consists in gradually bringing down into the sense world what originally only existed in the supersensible, the Greeks, for example, really still thought with their soul. Their thinking was entirely of a soul nature. Modern human beings, especially since the middle of the 15th century, think with their brain. Materialism is a perfectly correct theory when applied to modern human beings, for what the Greeks still experienced in the soul has gradually imprinted itself on the brain and has become hereditary in the brain from generation to generation. Today, human beings have started to think by means of the brain's imprints. They already think by material processes. In short, they think materialistically. That had to come. However, we must work our way upward again. We must add to these material processes by lifting ourselves to what comes from the supersensible world. We now have to do the opposite of what occurred when the soul was formally imprinted into the body. That is, we have to take hold in freedom of the spiritual supersensible through spiritual science. Let me read that again. We now have to do the opposite of what occurred when the soul was formerly imprinted into the body. That is, we have to take hold in freedom of the spiritual supersensible through spiritual science. If the development of humanity is to progress, we must undertake this consciously, this bringing down of the supersensible into the sense world. We must consciously bring the human body, this body of the senses, into visible movement in a way that up to the present occurred invisibly, unconsciously. We shall be consciously continuing along the path of the gods if we take over their work of imprinting thought upon the brain and convert supersensible eurythmy into sense-perceptible eurythmy. Should we fail to do this, humankind would gradually sink into daydreams, would become somnolent. Things would come to such a pass that, although various influences would flow from the spiritual worlds into the human ego and astral body, this would happen only during sleep, and on awakening, these influences would never be transmitted to the physical body. When people do eurythmy, through their movements, the physical organism becomes a receptive organ for the spiritual world, for the movements that want to come down from there. By preparing themselves for this, eurythmists become receptive to what is directed out of the spiritual world. For the audience, the movements living in their astral body and ego are intensified through experiencing eurythmy movements in visible form. If you were suddenly to wake up in the night after a eurythmy performance, you would find that you felt much more satisfaction inwardly than if you had awakened after hearing a sonata or at an evening concert. Eurythmy has an even stronger effect. It strengthens the soul by bringing it into living contact with the supersensible. A certain healthy balance, however, must be maintained, for if you have too much of it, the soul will fidget about in the spiritual world at night when one should sleep, and this restlessness in the soul would be the counterpart of physical nervousness. You see how such things suggest an ever more real and active perception of this marvelous structure, our human organism. We become aware, on the one hand, that nothing exists in our body that is not permeated with spirit. On the other hand, we see that the spirit and the soul aspire not to remain separated from physical experience. And it is especially interesting to allow everything I have presented today to work on you. Let it invigorate you. For instance, in active meditation, you can form for yourself a mental image of the musical life within us in the will region of visual experience. Then meditate further on the existence of musical memory in the thought region of visual experience, and vice versa. Connect what is in the region where we have mental images of the audible with what is in the region of the memory of visual experience. If you bring all these things together and form mental images of them in active meditation, you can be sure that the vigorous power of ingenuity you need when facing the children you are educating will be kindled in you. ideas like these, stemming from a spiritual, scientific method of education, have as their aim a more intimate knowledge of the human being. When you meditate on them, you cannot halt their continued effect within yourself. You see, when you eat a piece of bread and butter, first you are aware of a conscious action. But what takes place when the bread and butter pass through the complicated process of digestion is something you can affect very little. Yet this process takes its course, and your general well-being is closely bound up with it. Now, if you study physiology, as we have done, you experience it consciously to start with. But if you meditate upon it afterward, an inner process of digestion goes on in your soul and spirit. And that is what makes you an educator and teacher. A healthy metabolic process makes an active human being out of you. And in the same way, this meditative digestion of a true knowledge of the human being makes you an educator. You simply face the children as their teacher in an entirely different way if you have experienced what results from a genuine spiritual scientific knowledge of the human being. What makes us into educators actually grows out of the meditative work of acquiring such knowledge. Such observations as we have made today, if we keep returning to them, if only for 5 minutes a day, will bring our inner soul life into movement. We shall produce so many thoughts and feelings that they will just pour out of us. Meditate in the evening upon such knowledge of the human being, and in the morning you will know in a flash, quote, "Of course, this or that is what I must do with Johnny Miller," close quote, or, quote, "This girl needs this or that," close quote, and so on. In short, you will know what to do in every case. In our human life, it is important to bring about this sort of cooperation between inner and outer experiences. You do not even need much time for it. Once you have got the knack, in 3 seconds you can get an inner grasp of things that will keep you going for a whole day's teaching. Time loses its significance when it is a matter of bringing the supersensible to life. The spirit simply has different laws. Just as everything contracts in a dream, just as everything contracts in a dream, things we receive from the spirit can expand. In the same way, on waking up, you can have a thought whose time content could fill weeks, but shoots through your mind in no time at all. So, permeating yourself through meditation with this spiritual scientific knowledge of the human being can bring you to the point, when you have reached your 40th or 45th year, to carrying out, in 5 minutes, the whole inner transformation that you need for your teaching. You will be quite different than in ordinary life from what you were before. One can read about such things in the writings of those who have experienced them. You can begin to understand them, but you must also understand that what is experienced by a few individuals to an especially high degree, in a way that can then throw light upon the whole of life, must take place on a smaller scale in the teacher's case. As teachers, we must take up for ourselves the study of the human being. We must come to a comprehension of the human being through meditation. We must keep in our memory the nature of the human being. Then the memory will become vigorous life. It is not the usual kind of remembering, but one that gives new inner impulses. In this instance, memory wells forth from the life of the spirit and carries initiatives over into our external work. This is the third stage. Meditative comprehension is followed by active, creative remembering, which is, at the same time, a receiving of what emanates from the spiritual world. We start with an acceptance or perception of knowledge of the human being. Then comes comprehension, a meditative comprehension of this knowledge that becomes inward and is received by the whole of our rhythmic system. Finally, we have a remembering of the knowledge of the human being out of the spirit. This means teaching creatively out of the spirit. The art of education comes about and takes form. This must become a conviction, must become a direction of soul. You have to see the human being in such a way that you constantly feel these three stages within yourself. The more you are able to say to yourself, there is my physical body, there is my skin. They enclose the being who receives the knowledge of the human being, who meditatively comprehends it, whom God has blessed and invigorated through remembering it. The more you have this feeling within you, the more you will be a genuine teacher. The end of Lecture 3.